you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor and Manuel Betancourt, contributing editor at Film Quarterly. First up, the horror film The First Omen, starring Nell Tiger Free. The film is directed by Arkasha Stevenson, and Arkasha is one of the writers, along with three other credited screenwriters. Manuel, what do you think of The First Omen?
I mean, as a horror cinema agnostic, this is not my genre. I was kind of entertained. This is a prequel to the 1976, classic about the Antichrist child. And so we are in Rome and we're following this nun who finds herself in a conspiracy, finding this conspiracy about how the church is going to create this Antichrist who we have met for decades and in various iterations. It's a fascinating entry into what appears to be now the Omenverse, and it's very fascinated with female body autonomy and agency. It's basically a Rosemary's Baby. Very gruesome, very gory. There were a lot of moments when I had to look away. But I will say Nell Tiger-Free is fantastic, and she is the movie. It's a little silly at times, and there were a lot of groans in the audience for a couple of things, especially the final line that did make me just roll my eyes and be like, oh God, do you really have to go there? But I will say, Sonia Braga on screen is never nothing to sneeze
so
at.
So true.
And she is plays this imperious, mysterious, creepy nun, and she's great.
I'm not surprised. There's Gregory Peck back in the original Omen film.
Right, right.
Yeah. The First Omen, rated R, starring Nell Tiger-Free, Arkasha Stevenson, the director, and it's in wide release. Monkey Man has Dev Patel as a triple threat. He stars in the film, directs the movie, and is one of the three screenwriters. Peter, what'd you think of the action thriller Monkey Man?
Well, Dev Patel definitely does not want to be known anymore for, Kim or Slumdog Millionaire. This is basically his attempt to be the new John Wick, Mumbai style. It's in pulp terms, inspired by the legend of Hanuman, which is the monkey deity, the Hindu monkey deity. And we first see him in a kind of an underground fight club where he's wearing a gorilla mask, and basically he's the bad guy in these, but they're not staged. I mean, he's really getting pulverized in all of these matches, and there's some sort of masochistic element that happens, but it's a vengeance movie, because when he was a kid, his single mom, he was very close to her, and then these real estate developers came into their community and the chief of police, and they wiped out the community. They murdered the mom. So he's after the chief of police, basically, who murdered his mom, and he infiltrates this sort of high-class club to get to all these high rollers who were responsible. And it's extraordinarily violent, even for a film like this. It's also very self-consciously in the John Wick mold. There's even a character at one point that says, so do you like John Wick? There's also some Rocky stuff in here. Instead of Rocky pounding a side of beef, Dev Patel is, training by hitting bags of rice. For what it is, it's quite effective, and Patel is a credible action hero. When you look at Keanu Reeves, you don't necessarily think of him as being, some hulky action star either. And so it works, in that sense. And it's well directed, again, for what it is. There's a lot of smash and grab pyrotechnics in the camera work and so forth. But for this kind of movie, it's effective.
Monkey Man is rated R. It's in wide release. The Beast is a French sci-fi romance starring Léa Seydoux as well as George Mackay. The film's written and directed by Bertrand Bonello. What do you think, Manuel, of The Beast?
This is a wild and unruly film. There's like three timelines. We're in the future where a woman is trying to scrub her DNA so as to not feel anything and be a better worker. And so she gets to experience these two past lives that she's had, one in sort of 19th century France and the other in 2014 Los Angeles. And the movie is loosely inspired on Henry James's The Beast in the Jungle, which anyone who's read it is sort of about the lives you could have led if you had not been sort of so consumed with the dread of longing and the dread of sort of something looming on the horizon. And that kind of anxiety and that kind of looming fear infects the entire movie. It's quite long and it is very ambitious. And both Seydoux and Mackay are fantastic. I was more drawn to the more Jamesian sort of we're in, you know, these ill-fated lovers are meeting, and I like that better than the bleak sort of LA set or even the more sort of obliquely dystopian. But there's a lot to love here and a lot to grapple with, which I just really enjoyed in that sense.
And even with part of that setting of it, the film is in French with English subtitles. Peter, what'd you think of The Beast?
Well, you know, it's a 2.5-hour movie. And I would say for the first half hour, if I didn't have a professional obligation, I might have, you know, decided to take it's very slow and convoluted. As Manuel said, it sort of shifts back and forth between three different time zones, you know, the Belle Epoque, 2014, 2044. There's a lot of, highfalutin stuff about AI and, you know, losing our memories and anonymity in the future and, you know, all this stuff. I don't know that it really amounts to a hill of beans. It's just sort of window dressing for what's essentially a kind of David Lynchian experiment in a way. I mean, there's a lot of Twin Peaks-ish stuff in this movie, I think consciously so. And so it got a little better for me later on there's one terrific scene where, you know, there's a doll manufacturing plant on fire, and the two of them have to escape by going into a pool and trying to swim out from underneath, which is really quite harrowing and powerful. And there's some creepy stuff in the L.A. scenes with Mackay as a kind of stalker. And, you know, they're both quite effective. Seydoux is worth seeing in anything. Mm. But I think it's, a sort of fancy form version of Much Ado About Nothing.
We're talking about The Beast, the French film, which is unrated. You can see it at AMC's Burbank 16 and at the Landmark Sunset in West Hollywood. The Greatest Hits, a romantic comedy starring Lucy Boynton and Justin H. Min. It's written and directed by Ned Benson. Manuel, what did you think of The Greatest Hits?
I was so surprised by this film, because reading the logline, it sounds kind of hokey. So we're following Boynton's, and she's this woman, Harriet, who's dealing with the grief. Her boyfriend was killed in a car crash 2 years ago, and she's stuck that whenever she hears a song that she first heard with that boyfriend, she's transported back to that moment. And of course, this is a perfect metaphor for grief. Like when we lose someone, when we see something of theirs, when we have shared something, like it just brings us back. And for here, it's tangible. And she's actually time traveling. And of course, she's spending the entire movie being like, can I keep him from dying? Which is also a kind of fascinating. So it's a little bit, you know, Eternal Sunshine meets High Fidelity, because it's all about records and vinyls. And she's like trying to find the right song to get her to the right moment, all the while not dealing with, of course, the underlying grief. And I think that's where the movie really surprised me. And it really hit me. And maybe I was just in the right mood. But I just found it so charming and so grounded in this sort of like lo-fi, sci-fi, rom-com. And this is also the film that you will be able to see the upcoming Superman, David Corenswet, So if you're, you know, itching to see what that's going to look like, he has a bit part here as the boyfriend.
All right.
Long lost boyfriend.
We're talking about The Greatest Hits, written and directed by Ned Benson, starring Lucy Boynton and Justin H. Min. You can see it in a week run that's on right now at the AMC Burbank Town Center. And then next Friday, April 12th, it'll begin streaming on Hulu. The Greatest Hits is rated PG-13. The documentary Girls State follows the 2020 documentary Boys State. That film looked at boys who go to this annual gathering and run for different governmental positions within the context of the week-long event. There is a girls' version of it, and girls come from all across Missouri to be part of it. Girls State is directed by Amanda McBaines and Jesse Moss. You'll be hearing from them later on the program. We'll be talking with him about Girls State. Peter, what did you think of the documentary?
Well, it's inevitably interesting. It's about 500 girls from Missouri who are in this, I believe it's a week-long event, and sponsored by the American Legion. There's also the boys' event, which for the first time in the history of these events is on the same campus at the same time, although they're fairly segregated in terms of, you know, getting together or anything like that. It's whenever you make a film like this, and I'll be curious to hear what the filmmakers say, but, you know, you have to sort of choose in advance who you're going to go after, and, you know, on the assumption that some of them are going to advance high enough so that it's worth, you know. And that's sort of the case here. There's some, you know, really fascinating examples. There's a girl, Nisha, who seems to be from India, I believe, and she is very self-conscious, but she wants to be chosen for the Supreme Court. And but, you know, she feels a little bit clueless about all of this. And so she and friends encourage her to watch the movie Legally Blonde to kind of get with the zeitgeist. There's a girl named Emily who's comes on very strong in the beginning and says that, you know, she's been the president of every club she's ever been. Like, she lives like 15 clubs in high school. She reminded me of Reese Witherspoon in Election, you know, just sort of, you know, annoyingly gung ho. And then there's another girl, Faith, who's very left wing as opposed to Emily's professed conservatism. So there's a real mix here. What I found fascinating is that these are all basically 16-year-olds, and yet many of them profess, you know, a real about distaste for sexism, for patriarchy, for all of these things that much older women, you know, in older generations are dealing with now. But and I don't think, if you know, even 10 years ago, if you had made this movie, you would have been hearing this kind of chorus. So, I mean, I thought that was, you know, I mean, how much of their lives are affected by sexism at that age as opposed to later on? You know, are they mouthing what they're hearing from their parents and so forth? Or is this something that directly affects them? To some extent, they talk about this. I wish there had been a little bit more of the informal, you know, get-togethers of them and hear what they have to say about it more informally. But it's, you know, it's a fascinating movie. There's a certain cult-like aspect to this whole process, which I found a little creepy. You know, they have to sort of sing songs and clap on cue and, you know, make cupcakes and you know, they're upset that they're not getting as much as the boys are and so forth. You know, so there was that aspect to it, which is not entirely dealt with, I think. But you know, it's a fascinating cross-section of what's going on with at least that generation in this state.
Girls State, the documentary on Apple TV Plus. Manuel.
I loved Boy State, and I felt when I watched it in 2020, like, here is a terrifying portrait of the American political system. Girls State tries to do the same thing, but of course it ends up being about how difficult it is to be a woman and to be a woman in politics and to be a girl and to be a girl that's being empowered in very condescending ways, to be like this idea, like girl power. And so while the boys are discussing like actual policies, the girls are like, we're women and we all support each other. And some of them being like, the Roe v. Wade decision is about to drop. Why are we not having more intense conversations about it? And I think when those moments happen, because this does happen in the week when the decision was leaked and then when the decision was eventually passed down by the Supreme Court. It's when the sort of urgency of what's happening here and the disparity and the inequality of the Girl State program, especially compared to the Boy State program, which is happening right across campus, I think that's when the documentary really comes alive and becomes, again, an indictment of just the American system and also, you know, misogyny and sort of the need for these programs and also the sort of banality of them at the same time.
We're talking about the documentary Girl State from directors Amanda McBaines and Jesse Moss. We'll hear from that team coming up a little bit later. Girl State, the documentary, is streaming on Apple TV+. Coming up, we'll talk about the French drama Farewell, Mr. Halfman, and many more films. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Manuel Betancourt and Peter Rayner. Up next is the French drama Farewell, Mr. Halfman, set in 1941 occupied Paris. The film stars Daniel Auteuil. The film is directed by Fred Cavaillé, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Peter, what did you think of Farewell, Mr. Halfman?
It's a very good movie. It's based on a play that's well known in France, but you don't really get the sense that this is a stage adaptation. It's fluid without being overly conscious of being cinematic, quote unquote. It's set in occupied Paris in 1941, and Daniel Auteuil plays a Jewish jeweler, a highly respected jeweler, at a time when all of the Jews have been required to declare themselves as Jews to the authorities. And so, seeing the writing on the wall, he quickly dispatches his wife and children to the free zone in the countryside. His plan is to sell the jewelry shop to his assistant, and then when the war is over, when things improve, he'll come back and buy it back from him. But his plan to escape himself is stymied, and he ends up hiding out in the basement of the jeweler shop, with no end in sight. As Holocaust dramas go, I think the advantage to this film is that ultimately it's a psychological study. It's about the Daniel Auteuil character, Mr. Halfman, and this worker played by Gilles Lellouche, wonderfully played, whose wife Sarah Giraudoux is played by Sarah Giraudoux, is also a wonderful actress. She's childless. They have he dotes on her, but he's not the jeweler that Mr. Halfman was. And when the Nazis start coming in to get jewelry for their girlfriends, after a while they realize that the brooches aren't up to snuff. So Halfman has to make the jewels in the basement, and it becomes very complicated. And there's also the added thing, which I won't get too much into, but they're childless, and so how do you deal with that? With Mr. Halfman in the basement. So it becomes a psychological study. And originally, the associate is a good guy. I mean, he's risking his life to hide Mr. Halfman, but then things change. The calculus changes of their relationship. Things become scarier and more fraught. And it's all very well played. Daniel Auteuil is a wonderful actress. He's always so versatile in all that he does. So I think it's a very good movie that doesn't belie its stage origins.
Farewell, Mr. Halfman is the film. The French drama is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. and Lemley's Town Center 5 in Encino. Housekeeping for Beginners is a drama that is in Macedonian, Romani, Albanian, and French with English subtitles. It was the Queer Lion winner at the Venice Film Festival last year. It's written and directed by Goran Stolevski, and it stars Anna Maria Marinka. Manuel, what do you think of Housekeeping for Beginners?
This is a gorgeously messy and humane portrait of a found family. So Stolevski directed Of an Age, which is one of my favorite queer films of the past few years, and he returns now to his native Macedonia to offer us this portrait of Dida, a woman who never wished to be a mother, but, you know, when her girlfriend dies, she's left to care for her two daughters, including a very rowdy and very angry and very broody teenager. But Dida and her girlfriend had made of their home this kind of queer commune. So their friend Tony lived there and brought a bunch of hookups, but there's also all these like young teenagers who had found refuge there. So it's this like really messy kind of grouping who now have to sort of figure out how to move now that the central anchor couple isn't there. And it's just, it's shot so beautifully. It's so naturalistic. You almost feel like you're watching a documentary. Stolevski said that he was, you know, fascinated by this photo that someone had posted of someone who in Australia in the 70s had grown up in this kind of queer commune. And so he's just truly just following these characters, and you feel they're so lived in, and they've been so sort of carefully sketched together that I just wanted to live with them, even though there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of yelling, you know, there's a teenager who's just, you know, you're not my mother and you'll never will be, but so I'm going to go back to my Romani sort of roots, but then that comes with its own sort of struggles. I was just really bowled over by it, and I can see why I won the Queer Lion at Venice.
It sounds like a slice of life. I mean, not what we would think of as typical, but a very specific experience. And is it set back in the 70s or present day?
No, it's present day. So it's present day Macedonia. And I think that's what gives it a sense of like, of course, these were two women who couldn't openly live together as a couple. So when one of them dies, everyone approaches Dida and was like, oh, I heard your cousin died. And she has to be like, yes, that is who died, because that is what we presented to the world. So there, it's this... It's always hard to figure out where it was going, because you do feel like you're just witnessing. And Stolevski has such a deft hand with actors, especially younger actors, that it's just masterful here.
It sounds great. Goran Stolevski's film, Housekeeping for Beginners. It's rated R. You can see it at AMC's Century City and at The Grove in Mid-City Los Angeles. Scoop, a biographical drama starring Rufus Sewell and Keeley Hawes. The film is directed by Philip Martin, and it's written by Jeff Busettil by Peter Moffat. It's on Netflix. Peter, what did you think of Scoop?
Well, it's very crisp and effective. It's sort of in the spotlight, she said, category. You know, the Brits can do this too. Usually these movies are written by Peter Morgan, who did Nixon and Frost
right,
and every other movie.
The Queen and, yeah.
The Queen, yeah. I mean, so I guess he took a little siesta from this one. But, it's based on the... there was a famous, ultimately televised interview with Prince Andrew regarding the Jeffrey Epstein affair that aired on BBC, and the film is sort of a run-up to how that all happened. Billy Piper plays Sam McAllister, who was the producer who overcame a lot of dissension within the BBC for, you know, doing something that some felt was sort of queasy and exploitative. And Gillian Anderson is the head, you know, interviewer for the show, ultimately with Prince Andrew, wonderfully played by Rufus Sewell. With padding and so forth, but he looks exactly like Prince Andrew, and I imagine sounds very much like him too. It's very well done. There are no nuances particularly. You obviously know where it's going. But it's effective for what it does. It doesn't quite get into, you know, what the royals thought of Prince Andrew. At one point, you know, Prince Andrew says, well, I'll get back to you when they ask if he'll sit for the exclusive interview. He says, I have to ask Mummy, you know. So I would have liked to get a little bit more from, you know, Mummy's side about all this. She basically said, you know, do what you want. And there's a little thing at the end where they say, you know, Prince Andrew ultimately had to step down from his duties and so forth. And but I notice he's still being called Prince Andrew, and he shows up at all the, you know, royal events. So I don't know how much of a slap on the wrist that was. But it's an effective movie, and I particularly like Rufus Sewell.
I think there was a documentary that was made about that interview and how it all went sideways for the prince.
Yeah, and there's apparently another movie in the works about this as well. Yeah,
Scoop is the film we're talking about, directed by Philip Martin Manuel.
Yeah, this is perfectly fine. I don't know. It felt like the crownification of royal history. Or like, there's a lot of telegraphing of what we already know, and I don't know that I found that much depth in either about Prince Andrew or the crown or like the royals or even the BBC. It felt kind of weightless to me, unlike the kinds of things it's trying to be. Specifically, I think Frost Nixon, which is a better version of this, but I think the Frost Nixon interview was a lot more exciting. I do wonder what it would feel like for a British audience to see this, because I'm obviously coming from it from stateside. But to me, it just, effective is a good word, because I can't think of more to say about it.
I read a couple of the British newspaper reviews of this because I was curious, like from The Guardian, and they mostly didn't like it. You know, they said it didn't do anything for me, you know.
Yeah.
Scoop is the film. It's streaming on Netflix. It's rated TV-14. Le Samurai was released in 1967, starring Alain Delon, the film directed by Jean-Pierre Melville, who co-wrote it. Peter, share with us about the 4K re-release of this film.
Yeah, it's a classic. Jean-Pierre Melville was actually a precursor of the new wave. He appears in Breathless as a sort of elder statesman, and directed all sorts of terrific crime movies and also some other types of films. He did a great Cocteau adaptation, Les Parents Terribles. This is one of his best. It's Alain Delon is a hitman, and he goes through all the usual conniptions that hitmen go through, you know, in getting pursued and pursuing. It's beautifully shot. It's Delon, at the time, Delon was considered, you know, the best looking man in movies. And I think to some extent he's sort of self-conscious about this, because he has like a poker face for the entire film. He just doesn't move a muscle, you know, and Nathalie Delon, who was his wife at the time, is also in it. I mean, it's got a great cast, you know, but Melville's real name was Jean-Pierre Grombach. And he changed it to Melville in honor of Herman Melville, although I can't think of a writer who has less to do with what Melville is doing as a director. But it's definitely worth seeing. You know, I think it really holds up.
Le Samurai from 1967, getting a brand new 4K re-release. The unrated film in French with English subtitles is at Lemley's Royal in West Los Angeles and Lemley's Glendale. Musica is a film that stars Rudy Mancuso, who directed the movie as well and co-wrote it with Dan Lagana. Manuel, what did you think of Musica?
I think Musica will be, it's a great calling card for Mancuso, who stars, writes, directs, co-wrote, wrote the music for it. He got his start in doing vines and doing a lot of like puppetry, and you can sort of feel this sort of sketch-like comedy and vibe and sort of short spurts throughout the movie, which is sort of, as he says, it's based on a true story, unfortunately, because it's based on his own, about how he came to, you know, it's a very well-worn kind of tale of like an immigrant child torn between what his Brazilian mother wants him to do and then what he really wants to do, which is pursue puppetry, which I think a lot of mothers, not just Brazilian ones, would.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not national specific concern.
And then, of course, he's torn between this like Anglo white girl that he's been dating for a while, and then this like Brazilian American girl played by Camila Mendes of Riverdale fame. It's all a little schematic, and I think you know exactly where the movie is going. He has a lot of directorial flourishes, and you can see him just trying to do everything. He does puppetry, and he does music, and then there's lyrics on screen, and then there's choreographed dancing, and it's colorful, and it's in Newark, and I just wanted the movie sometimes to slow down and to really give me more character or give me more characterization. He gets shot at one point, and then like that sort of never gets talked about it again. There's a lot of that. There's more interest in the visuals and really cool sort of on-camera tricks. and really fun puppetry than anything else. But it's enjoyable and admirable, if very slight.
We're talking about the film Musica, as Manuel sang, set in Newark, New Jersey. Rudy Mancuso is the star, the director, and the co-screenwriter. It's rated PG-13, and you can see it on Amazon Prime Video. It's out now. Kim's Video, a documentary about a New York City video store. It's a tribute to that location. Peter?
Yeah, this is, if you were in New York at all in the 80s or the 90s, the Mecca was Kim's Video, which was a video store, mostly VHS, owned by a Korean gentleman who lived in, I believe, New Jersey. Young man Kim, who had 55,000 titles, a lot of them bootlegged. They was constantly being raided, and you know. So ultimately, with DVDs and streaming and you know whatnot, he decided to upload his entire holdings to, of all places, a small town in Sicily, which was supposed to curate it and have it open to all cineasts. Well, that didn't happen, and the filmmakers went to Sicily to find where the library was, and instead it's just, you know, all this unboxed stuff in bad warehouses. So they steal the stuff and bring it back. You know, it's a fascinating story. The movie is a mess. It also doesn't really tell you how they financed all of this.
What do you think, Manuel?
It is such a mess. There's a fascinating story. There's a heist. There's the mafia. There's Kim. There's so much here, and ultimately, it's a mess, and it doesn't really quite do justice to what I imagine Kim's Video and its legacy is supposed to have.
The documentary titled Kim's Video, it's directed by David Redman and Ashley Sabin. You can see it at the Alamo Draft House in downtown Los Angeles and Vidiot's in Eagle Rock. When we come back, we'll talk to the directors of the new documentary Girl State on Apple TV Plus. When we come back in just 1 minute on Film Week.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.